Welcome to Our Hen House. This is Jasmine Singer.
This is Marianne Sullivan.
And this week, Marianne will be speaking with Kimberly Carroll, who is a coach for change makers of all sorts and is also the force behind Animal Justice Academy, which helps grassroots activists who want to help animals up their game so that they can maximize their potential. And I know that you thought this was a really cool, very different interview.
Great interview. I really felt like, you know, she was part of the ethos that I like to think is sort of behind our hen house. It's like talking to people who don't necessarily work in the movement. Some of them do, some of them don't. And just want to do something, you know, and are unsure what to do. And what she's done is really great. They have these weekly sessions and they have a course and it's really great. So I highly suggest to anybody out there who's, well, for anybody to listen to it, but especially for people who are just in the, you know, I got to do something mode. It's really going to be helpful.
There's definitely a lot of synergy there with our hen house. So very exciting. I can't wait to hear it. And I am currently still riding the high from my last weekend because I was out of town and now I'm back.
International travel.
Yes. We live like an hour and a half away from Canada. So Moore and I went up to Toronto for the weekend. I took off from my job at Weekend Edition, got a sub, told people I'm not checking my email. I checked it a little anyway, but I did pretty well with that.
We're overdoing the detail on getting away from your job. Let's get to Toronto, okay?
We were celebrating 50 cumulative years of veganism between the two of us. Moore has been vegan for 30 years. That was in January. And in May, I will have been vegan for 20 years. And so last year, when I realized that we were both celebrating our 20 and our 30, like a few months apart, I was like, oh, March is in between. And so I used all of my credit card points and I booked us a hotel downtown. I was like, we can cancel it if we want to. And suddenly it's March and we went. And I have to say, we had the best time. I love Toronto. I say Toronto because people who live there say Toronto, not Toronto. So for those of you who think I'm not articulating, you are.
I always
incorrect.
Heard that they say Trana.
I don't know. I mean,
is that going too far?
I think a little, which is usually me who's going too far. So the tables have turned. Tables have turned indeed. Anyhow, so we just like honestly ate our way through the city as one does as a veganversary
that
calls
is
for.
The goal of all travel, isn't it?
I'm not like, as we've discussed before, I'm not actually like a foodie, really. I mean, I like good food like anyone else, but there are people and a lot of vegans really care deeply about combining this taste with that taste and don't ever put this taste with this taste. And I just am like, whatevs. But so, you know, I just want you to know, I thought the food I had was out of this world good. Like I went to the Danish bakery, which is a whole bakery that's Danish. Hence the name. And just all of these glorious, I had tarts.
Is it all vegan?
Yeah, all vegan. I had tarts. Moore had I'm trying to remember where she had this. If it was, it was there. She had a croissant, a Boston cream croissant. So it was like a Boston cream donut and a croissant. It was almost like a cronut.
That is such a good idea.
Yeah, and I mean, it looked amazing. I had something else. That was when I got my lemon tart. I mean, scones. We went to the Animal Liberation Kitchen, which was so cool. And I love that it's so animal rights minded, obviously, with a name like that. And it was in this building that had a gym in it. So people just after the gym pop up to the Animal Liberation Kitchen for their smoothie or whatever. And they're like, you know, inundated with the truth about animals.
Oh, that's
just
great.
By nature.
That's really cool.
It was amazing. And
I was thinking, like, you when you said it was in this other building, and I was thinking, oh, you know, it's like one of those places that it's the best they could do because they're small, but you know, it's out of the way. But that is really great placement, great location. If they get all the gym rats.
100%. We went to the Hogtown Vegan, which, by the way, we got a really good parking spot when we were going to Hogtown Vegan. And so we were only like two blocks away. And we get out of the car and immediately see a vegan fast food restaurant called Odd Burger. And So the reason I brought up the parking was because we had very little, walking time in between, and we still found a vegan fast food place, which was just so cool. And like
the reason it's called Hogtown is that that is the unfortunate nickname given to Toronto.
Oh yeah,
because there were hog slaughterhouses. I don't think there still are, but there are hog slaughterhouses. I feel like I heard that the last one closed, but you know, I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Hog slaughterhouses up until very recently, right in town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've forgotten about that, honestly, but this, like, I love turning that on its head, right? Like Hogtown Vegan. It's so,
yeah.
It was just everything we did. Like, we walked in the labyrinth in High Park, and then we went to IKEA because that's what we do. And we like went gambling and and lost our money at the slot machines, but we didn't go above our budget. So I consider that a win. And that, yes, that's me squinting my eyes and cocking my head and considering it a win.
Well, as long as you don't go beyond your budget, then it's just a night out of frustration and loss, and misery. But it's still just a night out. It's not like you're headed to the poorhouse.
Well, it's just a night out with like angst, but that's me anyway. So why not?
Right. No, gambling is like, for me too, gambling is like spending money to buy anxiety. Oh, great.
I just had the most wonderful time and I just love that city so much. We also went to Buffalo and Batavia. We ate in Batavia, which is a town between Rochester and Buffalo. There's an incredible restaurant called Eden. And God.
That place is amazing.
It's so good.
I haven't actually been there since they opened up. They opened a storefront. They used to be part of another, like they had one booth in another group of fast food places. But now they have their whole restaurant and their food is superb.
It's even better now. It's so good.
You know, it's particularly fun to find vegan restaurants. And, you know, Batavia's not a big town. I'm going to say it's the middle of nowhere because we're around where I live. But kind of. It's not like crowded around there. And still, they seem to do some great business.
Yeah, it got even better. And then Buffalo, obviously, we love Strong Hearts. And we went to the art museum in Buffalo, which was like gorgeous. And it was beautiful. So I love celebrating things because, you know, things are so hectic usually, and just taking a moment to be like, no, I'm not bringing my computer with me and I'm just going to like unplug completely. It's like the world doesn't end and you wind up having a really wonderful time. So super excited about that. So let's talk a little bit about what's been going on with DXE.
Yeah, no, I feel like I should do an update, though a lot of you probably are already familiar with this story, that the trial that was pending against Wayne Hsiang and others that had to do with the DXE effort to take dogs out of Ridgeland Farms, which, you know, raises beagles for animal research places to use. This has been pending for a long time, like really a long time, like for years. And, you know, they're supposed to go to trial within a week and the DA moves for dismissal. This is the second time this sort of thing has happened in a DXE case. Both, I think it was Paul Picklesheimer and Wayne Hsiang both argued that they didn't want the charges dismissed, that they had been working on this for a really long time. They've spent an enormous amount of money on legal fees and whatever preparing for trial. They do this for a reason. I must admit, you know, I can't help but be relieved to some extent when charges are dismissed, because it does demonstrate how completely bogus these charges are. And, you know, I'm just always scared that something bad is going to happen and they're going to end up in prison. But really, this is just outrageous. The week before trial, and, you know, I read Wayne's piece on Substack, and his point was that he's pretty sure it was because they were just at the point where they were issuing a subpoena and trying to get information out of the DA about some of the uses to which these beagles were being put, the enormous amount of money that is involved in the use of these dogs in experiments. And according to him, through back channel sources, they found out that some of the customers of Ridgeland Farms are places like Pfizer, Eli Lilly, Merck, the big, big money. And they wanted to prove a point. And according to him, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if this were the case, They just got scared. What I think is particularly outrageous is, according to Wayne's Substack, the reason the DA put out, this is just so crazy. The reason they put out for dismissing the charges and dropping all the charges is, what has changed, said the DA, the prosecutor, are the death threats and the coming after the business that the victims have now started enduring. That is the change that has precipitated this motion to dismiss. As if prosecutors are in the habit of dismissing charges against people they think are criminals because there are threats. Isn't that a reason to pursue the charges? Isn't that a reason to like say, well, these are really, really terrible people and they really have to be locked up? Can you imagine a prosecutor saying, well, we can't take this person to trial because we're too scared and the business might be targeted? It's such bullshit. Oh my God. It makes me so mad. Really an outrageous story. And, you know, as he also points out, they had a lot of really, really big press lined up that were going to be part of the whole, you know, process of the charges going to trial and whatever happened at the trial, you know, including very big outlets. And now it's not really much of a story. So they're not really getting those big press opportunities. I mean, which is why they do this. This is why they went through all of this. I mean, in addition to saving dogs like Julie, who is a blind beagle who was taken out by them, they do it to bring attention and to have the opportunity to put their position before a jury. And now they won't be allowed to. Anyway, I'm going on and on because I'm mad. When is somebody going to do, like a big news outlet, like going to do an in-depth story about this outrageous situation that this keeps happening over and over again? I mean, they've spent at least $100,000 preparing for this trial, and it's not like they have it.
I really think it's bananas that big media still isn't covering DXC to the extent it should.
Oh, they should do a huge in-depth story about exactly this. The fact that these charges were dropped is more outrageous than if they had gone to trial.
Yeah, I totally agree. We'll link to a couple stories about this and continue to keep you posted. But I think we should get to Kimberly, because after a story like that, I want to have a dose of hope, and I want to give that to our listeners as well. So Kimberly Carroll is the director of the Animal Justice Academy, which helps folks become animal rights super soldiers, advocating for animals in their own communities in a way that suits who they are and what they uniquely have to offer. She's also a coach for Changemakers, a campaign strategist with Animal Justice, and a director with the Toronto Vegetarian Food Bank, speaking of Toronto. With over 13 years as a coach and 18 years as an activist, Kimberly works with mission-driven leaders, social entrepreneurs, and activists on the inner shifts, high-performance habits, and strategies to make them unstoppable. She's helped empower thousands of activists and counseled those in high-stress positions, such as undercover investigators. She will be joining Marianne right after this. If you like what you're hearing, please consider taking a moment to leave us a friendly review. You can do that on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Facebook, wherever you listen to podcasts, really, or wherever you're listening right now. Amazing reviews help our henhouse to climb the rankings so that we end up in more people's ears, where we can join forces to elevate the voices of the animals and those who are working to change the world for them. So thank you so much for taking the time to leave us a friendly review.
Welcome to our hen house, Kimberly.
Thank you, Marianne. So good to be here.
I am thrilled to have you here, because what you do is what we all want to get better at, what we at our hen house would like to encourage people to do. I mean, you are teaching people how to be better activists in a number of different aspects. But the thing I heard about you first was about Animal Justice Academy. But you also work as an activism coach. And I want to get into both of those. I think they're probably connected, but not really exactly the same thing. And so we have a lot to talk about. For those who are unfamiliar with it, can you describe what Animal Justice Academy is and what it does? Just the elevator speech.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so Animal Justice Academy is a free training course, a community, and an action collective for those who care about animals. We currently have 10,000 people enrolled in the course, which includes a couple of hundred teachers and speakers.
Oh my God, 10,000 people? Are you joking?
I'm not. You know what, Marianne, when we went to launch this in 2021, I said to my executive director at Animal Justice, I said, I'm going to get us 1,000 people. And she's like, no way. And by the time we started the program, we had 5,000 people enrolled, like within 2 weeks. Wow. And it's just kept growing from there.
I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I am shocked and overwhelmed. I want to hear so much more.
And that's the thing. I think it was just so needed. So let me tell you a little bit more about it. So we have the base course. Now we have a continuing education program where we do a lot of live online events. We have a couple of hundred teachers and speakers involved in this, names that you would know of and names that you haven't had the pleasure of knowing yet. This is all part of my organization, Animal Justices. It's a little outreach of Animal Justice. So Animal Justice is a leading national animal rights organization in Canada. And as a lawyer, you would know a little bit about this, but we lead the legal fight for animals in court and in the political arena. And a huge part of who we are as Animal Justice is educating public on animal issues through investigations, through campaigns, through media. And Animal Justice Academy, we were born out of a problem, Marianne, that a lot of animal advocacy groups have. And that's like, we inspire people to care through whatever we do, through our podcasts, through our investigations, through court cases. And then they're really hungry to do something, okay? Everybody wants to help. Everybody wants to volunteer. But most of us are organizations that are like bare bones, right? And we don't have the capacity to put thousands of people to work in any substantial way. I mean, we can get them to do an action here or there, but in a substantial way. And I kept thinking, you know, what a shame this is. You know, every investigation we put out, we get so many requests from people. What can I do?
Yeah, I totally hear you.
You probably hear this all the time, right? At our hen house. Yeah. And so I thought, what a shame not to tap into this valuable resource. So the idea with Animal Justice Academy is to basically train animal lovers to become animal rights super soldiers, advocating for animals in their unique communities and in ways that like suit their personality and their skills and their resources and their experience. And then being able to really create this mass in the movement, that this collective that can do more advanced advocacy. We've got animal AJAers, I call them, doing diplomacy to deal with lawmakers, you know, meeting with their reps, folks that have general social justice awareness that can help build a very inclusive movement. So I like to think of our AJAers and people who've done the program and do continue to work with us, that these are the people we call on when there's a more advanced action to be taken, both by Animal Justice and the movement at large. So we have lots of groups coming to us and saying, hey, we could use a little bit of arm power on this, or we could use a little bit of help from people that can write a brief, or we need letters to the editor written for this. And that's when I'm like, da 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 da, you know, Animal Justice Academy, do the rescue. So I'm really proud of them.
This is totally brilliant, totally brilliant. So the campaigns that you come up with, you're not the one necessarily who comes up with the campaigns. Of course, your relationship with Animal Justice, they are a campaign organization and you are part of that. So some of it comes from that. And then other groups will just tell you about campaigns that your folks might want to get involved in. And then you will spread the word about that. But they'll use the tools that they learned from Animal Justice in order to be more effective. Is that right?
Yeah, that's all right. For example, you had John Lewis on your show a while ago, and they're trying to kill us. We've done a couple of actions with John and the movie and trying to push that out a little bit more. Or Mercy for Animals, we just did a little collaboration with them last week around one of the biggest chicken operations in Canada. We're all, as organizations and groups in this movement, we might have different strategies, different approaches, different styles, but we're trying to help animals. And we just thought, like, it's really great to be able to do more collabs between organizations. And I think that's happening more and more. But if we can really instill that into our grassroots activists and our beginning advocates and everything, I think that's, you know, super important. So the center point of the course, Marianne, is a 6-week self-paced course.
Right. I really want to go into all of the different, because you have so many different topics. I don't even know how people cover all of this. It's amazing. Know. So I don't want to spend the whole interview on it, but I do want to go into some detail. Before I do that, I just want to ask you one question that I think is probably on a lot of people's minds who are listening. How much of this is just for Canada?
Yeah, well, about 60% of the AGAers, I'd say, are Canadian and the rest are international. So we try to keep everything pretty general. Some of the campaigns, because they're animal justice campaigns, tend to be Canadian-based. But a lot of the education, a lot of the live events, which we have 3 a month, they're basically pretty general. So for example, our AGA Lunchtime Live that we have every second week, we'll do everything from talking about animal advocacy careers to plant-based by default strategies to meeting with your political reps. So that can apply to everybody.
But what about the campaigns, like when organizations come to you, would most of that be necessarily Canada-based? I can't see how it wouldn't be.
Yeah, we are also open. Basically, we try to do many actions through AJA. Like, we try to put out collective actions all the time. So we will do them from a variety of places that basically really fit into what we do well. So for example, we were helping with social media, taking campaigns that abuse animals off of social media on an international stage. We have worked around getting rid of prison farms, things like that. So these can be more widespread campaigns.
But I think my real point here is I think you need to have a chapter in every single country in the world. This has to happen. So you would be able to allow people from other countries to join in these more general things and also have those terrific specific campaigns that you can kind of bring this army to bear.
Yes.
For an organization that has a great campaign going and needs to get the activists. And there you are, sitting there. It's just very exciting work.
We kind of have informal chapters because we have AJRs from all over the world. So they'll bring a campaign from New Zealand and say, hey, folks, can everybody do a piece of this? Or we have something, you know, that'll come from South America that they'll, you know, same thing. So, but you're right. I mean, Marianne, I would love to see something.
No, you need to take over the world.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I'm not sure if I'm the one, but this idea does.
You seem like pretty energetic, Kimberly. I think that you're the person. All right. I interrupted you, actually. We were going to go into actually a little bit more of a description of what the 6-week course is about. Can you get back to that question now?
Absolutely. Sure. So the center point of Animal Justice Academy is both the 6-week self-paced course, which has 80 modules in it, and then our continuing education events, which we have, like I said, about 3 a month. And it's topics from political engagement to building media skills, giving inside knowledge on animal use practices and industries. Like, for example, I've had a lot of veteran animal advocates come and do the first week of the program, which is all about this, and go, I had no idea about all of these different facets, and just to be able to give people the confidence to know what they're talking about whenever they advocate, whether you're advocating at work, whether you're advocating at city council, or whether you're advocating with your brother. It's important that you have the confidence to know what you're saying is true, right?
Because they will totally call you on it.
Absolutely. I mean,
especially the industry. Well, you know, you don't know anything about, as if the only people who can advocate for animal rights are people who work in the industry. That makes sense.
Absolutely. And they just assume because you're an animal advocate that you couldn't possibly have been to a farm ever in your life.
Right.
So, yeah, we all know that when you're an animal advocate, you are putting yourself in front of the firing squad and you need to be ready. You need to be able to deflect. And you also need to be able to fire some really powerful volleys back in a loving way. I will caveat that.
I'm not going to promise the loving part. I'm sorry.
We aspire to that.
Polite, maybe.
That's right. Polite, courteous and respectful.
Well, you're in Canada, too.
Well, we're not exactly the shining examples of courteousness.
I have met rude Canadians. I'm going to admit it. They're few and far between, but they definitely exist.
They do. We also do, you know, vegan education. Like, a lot of folks that can't come into AJA, they're not veg at all. They're coming in because they're dog rescuers or they work on horse issues, things like that. And so just being immersed in this sort of energy of this group that, again, is positive. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about how we've kept it positive. But we talk a lot about vegan education. We just talk about veganism as the thing we all aspire to. We talk about pressure campaigns. We teach about effective communications. We do a lot of work around intersectionality. We are very much based on, you know, this idea of overlapping oppressions, and the way that we need to open up the umbrella of this movement is to make this movement a kinder, better place for people from diverse backgrounds. One of my favorite things is we teach resilience building. So we teach all of those things that I do in my work as a coach for change makers, all the things to keep activists effective and enduring, okay, to avoid burnout, because that's, you know, that's the huge thing. And we can talk about that in a second. But
yeah, no, I definitely want to talk about that. Yeah. But I do want to get I'm just going to list the six modules, just so people know. Sure. Animal advocacy, the foundations, advocacy in our communities, engaging in the political system, exposing animal exploitation, expanding your influence and engaging media, empowering yourself as an advocate. I mean, it's such a really important and capacious list of skills that we all need. And is it primarily skill building? Do you do examples of various campaigns? Is it all over the lot? Like, let's say I sat down and decided to take the first module. What would I expect to see?
Each week is quite different. And so the first module that you're going to see is probably going to be around farm animal industry and really the lowdown on all aspects taught by an undercover investigator. Then, you know, the second week where we're talking about being in communities, very different modules. We have Melanie Joy talking about how do you speak and navigate your relationships with your close ones when you're an animal advocate. And then other modules around how do you weave your activism or your animal advocacy into the communities that you're already engaged in, your church groups, your school, your workplace, your sports clubs, you know, sort of new ways of thinking about advocacy. Because frankly, I think this is a big problem, Marianne, is a lot of people think of the movement as, I have to go and hold a sign and yell at people. And even though protests can be incredibly powerful, it's one tiny little piece of the advocacy puzzle.
And not always the best one in a certain situation.
Yeah. I mean, I've been a part of a lot of protests.
Me too. I'm all for them. I'm not against them. But, you know, you want to use your time most wisely. And if you don't have a large group, you're not going to have a big impact and it's going to be painful. There might be better ways to spend your time.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So we really try to teach how do you start thinking more about who you are, what your skills and talents are, what your passions are, what your resources are, how you like to work, and use that to start framing how you become an animal advocate. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, I say if somebody is out there doing outreach at a university and I know that they're a great graphic designer, I am going to take those cards and I'm going to hit them with them. You know, like there are a lot of skills that people don't think of that we need in this movement. So,
but also people need that structure. Mm-hmm. You know, people might have skills and know that they have those skills, but they don't know how to put them to work because, as you mentioned in the beginning, the organizations don't have sufficient structure for taking the grassroots and educating them and getting them on board. So even though they have those skills, they know they could use those skills, the structure for putting them to use doesn't exist. And I think that's what you are creating.
Yeah. And also trying to create some organizers, right? We have a lot of followers. We don't have enough organizers in this movement. Yeah. So that's why a lot of our events do, like you said, feature a lot of campaigns that are working, a lot of organizations that are working, a lot of strategies that are working, some gaps in the movement that desperately need somebody to step up in. So we're always kind of looking at that and going, what do you think of this? Could this work for you? Can you jump in? Who's interested? And so it's creating a lot of organizers, which I love. And that's a piece that I'm wanting to build on even more. So, I mean, each of our live sort of Zoom events attract like 100 to 400 people. So like live, that's pretty darn good in this movement. And so we have people really engaged, really hungry to do effective work.
Yeah. So what we've been talking about so far is the 6-week course, and that's free, right?
Yeah, everything's free.
Everybody can just get on and take that course.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly elaborate. And as you said, there will be many people you will have heard of. Mm-hmm. But then after that, as you were just referencing, you have these live online programs, kind of like a continuing education, would that be the way of thinking about it? So tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah. So those are we have a biweekly Animal Justice Academy Lunchtime Live. So those happen on Thursdays at noon Eastern time. We have just really, like I said, interesting campaigns, people who are doing interesting things. Some are pretty famous. Some are very new. When Apex first came out, we were right all over that. We talk about strategies around food procurement. We have had panel sessions around how to decolonize the animal rights movement, you know, things like that. So we work on a lot of different aspects, strategy, habits, and also with our lunchtime lives, I do a lot of coaching sessions. So I will do workshops around how to deal with pain as an animal advocate, yeah, or how to get your product activity up, things like that. So you basically just go to our YouTube channel and you can take part in a lot of different sessions that have happened. It's actually quite a goldmine of a resource, the Animal Justice Academy YouTube. And the other thing that we do to keep this community thriving is we obviously regularly communicate via email, but we also have a private Facebook group that I think is one of the sweetest places for animal advocacy online right now, because we tried really hard to make it so. So, Marianne, that was one of my personal projects with Animal Justice Academy. I wanted to see if we could build a supportive and respectful online community. Because as we know, online animal advocacy forums don't have a particularly good reputation, right?
No, I mean, online everything is problematic. But, you know, animal rights advocates tend to be passionate. Yeah. And infighting is a problem in any movement, and definitely in this movement. And I took this quote. You talk about creating a supportive and respectful AR community that welcomes debate, but within the spirit of bridge building. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds great, but unpack it a little bit. What exactly do you mean by that? And how do you make that happen? Because people... Oh, what's the expression? The small differences, the narcissism of small differences. Like, people get so focused on how they differ from each other rather than seeing that we actually agree on a lot of the big things. How do you make that happen?
Yeah, this sort of for me comes from this idea of wanting a vegan world as opposed to a vegan club. Yeah, so, you know, the sniping, the black and white thinking, the blaming and the shaming and the name calling, it just causes so much alienation. I've heard of so many people just leave the movement just because of online stuff that they're encountering. So this idea of, you know, a community bridge building, when we started, as I mentioned, we had 5,000 people signed up, and I knew by looking at the list, we had a longtime hardcore animal activists. We had complete newbies that were meat eating newbies from around the world. And I knew that there was just potential for all sorts of roiling conflict. Yeah. And so I was like, okay, we're going to do this. It's not going to be an easy task, but let's make it a simple one. So how we set it up is we made the ground rules and we put those front and center. The very first module you'll see in the academy is me talking about the spirit of this program. And the ground rules were everywhere. Expectations were front and center. And it was just a decision that in the beginning, we would put time towards mediating, which again, we don't have the resources in this movement to do a lot of mediating. Yeah, but when you mediate, oh, it is magical. I've been in the middle of a lot of mediating situations and I've done a lot of mediating. And I tell you, it doesn't take a lot to make a huge difference. So my moderators, myself, we were very fast to nip things in the bud, which really wasn't about slapping people's hands, but it was about demonstrating how one goes about having respectful discourse. So, you know, making both sides feel understood in order to keep the shame wall down. You know, that shame wall, as soon as somebody's told you're doing something wrong or you shouldn't be doing that, that shame wall goes up.
The difference between the way people communicate online and what they're willing to say to people. What happens to all of us when we go online, we turn into like different people.
I know.
And not better ones, that's for sure. No. Like, you just bring people together. Like, they're just a lot nicer.
Yes, absolutely.
9 times out of 10.
That's an important piece to remember. You know, when I talk a lot about how to keep your sanity on social media. And one of the things is imagine that person every time you say a comment. That person's in front of you. That person is flesh and blood. They have a universe of wants and likes and pains and joys inside of them. And let's conduct ourselves accordingly. So, you know, really getting in there and demonstrating in our own reactions what bridge building looks like. Lots of team language, lots of sort of love and understanding. I remember sort of in the height of this. I've been working on it. And there was one particular fella in there who had been a longtime activist. He did a lot, some investigative work. I think it was a Fox Sense saboteur. And he just kept on going after the people that were new that said, I'm not vegan yet, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, why aren't you? What's wrong with you? Why can you, you know, how? And just attacking them. And so every time I'd have to go and I'd have to mediate. And so finally, one time he went after somebody after we just had a sort of side conversation, and I direct messaged him and I said, what's going on? I know you care for animals. I know you're smart. I know you know this isn't the way to do it. What's going on? And he wrote me back and he said, I had an investigation today and it devastated me. And I'm just, I'm just not, you know, I
emotion
just
couldn't, took over. Yeah.
You know, and I said, so say that, share that. Share from your experience, share why you are the way you are, okay? And lo and behold, he got back on there and he said to this person, you know what, I understand that it's hard, you know, going vegan, because she was complaining about she was having trouble going vegan, it was hard. And she says, I understand, and you know what, I, you know, I'll just say from my place that it was one of the best things I could have ever done. It made me able to look at animals and not feel guilt and feel more clear to do this work. And he says, and if you need anything, I'm here. And oh my God, I just like, I was crying. I'm like, okay, they're getting it. They're getting it.
Yeah.
And then that person had such a great reaction. And within the next week, she was vegan.
You know, that really shows like how deeply the trauma had affected him, that it was, you know, it was overwhelming him. But we're all dealing with that a little bit. I mean, we're not undercover investigators. I'm not pretending I've gone through anything like that. But every animal advocate does deal with trauma. And, you know, I'm sure that has something to do why we get so impatient with people who are just like, you know, it just doesn't taste exactly like milk. It's frustrating. Tell us a little bit, and maybe this is going to overlap a little bit, because, you know, I said we were going to start off talking about the Animal Justice Academy, but you also do coaching, individual coaching of activists. And I am sure that grief has a lot to do with people being effective activists. So tell us a bit about that coaching and also about how you deal with people's grief.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I work part-time in the movement. I do a lot of pro bono work. I do some contract work, but my bread and vegan butter is as a coach for change makers, because Marianne, I just knew, even every time I was like, okay, well, I should take this campaign's job, or I should lead this organization or whatever. But I have always felt this incredible pull around helping the activists, because there is an epidemic of burnout and compassion fatigue and grief that is felling our movement, not just our movements, social justice movements in general. Actually, this is new to me, so it's still staggering for me, but 50% of activists burn out and quit the movement. Okay, because of mental and physical drain, 50%. Now, that is a huge turnover. If this was a corporation, that would be considered a massive emergency. And in our movement, it's just considered par for the course. And we can't be thinking that way anymore. Okay.
Well, also, you know, I think a little piece of it too, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but a piece of it, particularly in our movement, is that we're all allies. Yeah. So for everybody who's in this movement, they've decided to be in the movement. They don't have to be in the movement.
No, it's not their life and death.
No, it's not. So they've made a decision. So undoing that decision, for some people, it's easier than in other movements where you're actually the victim of the oppression.
Well, and there are so many pieces that make being an advocate in movements where you are the victim so much harder. But then there are also...
Of course. I'm not suggesting it would be good to be the victim. I'm just saying, from a coaching point of view, it's different.
And also, there are a lot of pieces of being an animal advocate that aren't in other social justice movements. Like, first of all, the sheer scale of what we're dealing with in animal advocacy.
Absolutely.
The numbers that are unfathomable, the degree of suffering that is just horrific.
And the power of these industries.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that people that are in animal activism have a particularly high empathy level to, again, be able to sacrifice a lot of their life and their normalcy to help someone outside of themselves and one of a different species that most of the population cannot relate to in the same way. And so I think we're drawn to this movement because we are sensitive and attuned to the most powerless of the world. And then what happens? we're exposed 24/7 to the extreme suffering. It's kind of a cruel joke, right? Then there is the whole idea of there's so few of us working in animal rights compared to other social justice movements. So the responsibility feels much heavier, and that results in much higher rates of sacrifice and sort of martyr complex. We're also going against the status quo at every turn. We get pushback from more than 90% of the population who aren't veg or veg friendly, including our inner circles, right? Then, again, this isn't any different than other social justice movements, but there's the infighting and marginalization within our own movement. So that's why I decided I had to dedicate a huge part of my life to helping activists with the inner healing and the resilience building habits, and also just really smart strategies to make them more powerful and more long-lasting.
Oh, this is individual coaching, right? That people can actually hire you to do.
I do individual coaching, but I also do a lot of group coaching. So I have free resources. Every second week, I do something I call the Changemaker Sessions. So it's a free workshop every 2 weeks. We get together as a community and we concentrate on, like I said, all of those pieces that are going to make us feel more empowered to be more effective and enduring as advocates.
And just to make sure that people understand, this is different from the Animal Justice Academy. And this might be for advocates in other movements as well. It's on how to be an activist.
Yeah, it's on how to not lose your shit being an activist is basically the shorthand, right? It's not necessarily about the nuts and bolts of theory of change and everything. It's about how do you best survive this and thrive in order for you to be more effective. And so we talk about everything from boundaries, how to process pain properly, what kind of daily practices you need, how to navigate conflict, how to find courage. I do the sort of building up, and then organizations like Animal Justice Academy or other organizations out there that do campaigns, they're the ones who can give you the campaigns to do. I make you strong for the campaigns. I make you strong for the work. That's what I do.
You mentioned burnout before. I've never liked the term burnout because it just sounds so final.
Yeah.
Like once you've burned out, you're gone. And I don't like that way of looking at it.
That's right.
But we all know it's something. Sometimes it's just too much. And how do you suggest people avoid just stopping when it becomes too much? What are the steps you can take when you feel like you just want to escape?
Yeah, it's such a natural feeling. I mean, a lot of people who sign up to be animal advocates, they don't know what they're signing up for.
Yeah.
It can be really, a really hard slog. And, you know, just to think about 92 billion land animals alone being killed every year, you know, and then trillions of marine life. I mean, even just that thought, there's so many reasons that we burn out. But I mean, the very first thing that I always recommend is we need to have boundaries. We need to create space for something else in our life. And that's really hard for animal advocates to hear because there's a lot of guilt tied up in this.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. As I mentioned, we have this sort of staggering sense of responsibility. And this has bred a culture of sacrifice in the animal rights movement. There's a lot of guilt if you're not sacrificing everything, but that's a fatal flaw. I mean, if we were to sacrifice everything, we don't survive. And then what good are we to anybody? Right? So it's about putting boundaries around your activism, whether that is putting a cap on the number of hours you work each week, whether it's getting really deliberate about the campaign or the issue that you're working on, and then being able to say no to the other things so that you can do what you're deliberate about well. It's about working according to some of your strongest skills, like doing your most impactful work instead of scattering your attentions into all these little places where you don't really have much to bring. It's about learning to put boundaries around graphic materials.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if you're on social media, they're coming at you all the time. And what do people do? If they watch them in the middle of their day with no grounding, with no space to process. They're watching some of the most horrific video that any humans have experienced, right?
I mean, there are very few people who, once they get started, feel like their commitment is slipping because they don't think it's bad enough.
Yes.
If you think it's not bad enough for you to bother, then watch those videos. But chances are that's not what the issue is. Oh. We all, once you've seen them once, you know.
Yeah. Sometimes when I get a little complacent, Marianne, it's important for me to watch things because, I can get a little complacent. And I also help produce undercover videos. So I am exposed to it on a regular basis. But what I've learned about this is if you are going to watch just for education's sake or because it's part of your work, you need to create a space to do that. Like if you need to collect links, like you see, okay, I need to watch that. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. Now. Collect the links, put them in a list. And once a week, or if you have to do it a lot, once a day, watch when you mm-hmm. have a chance, when there's not a bunch of things coming at you, when you yeah. take some deep breaths, you can ground. And afterwards you can have a good cry or you can write it out, you know, and just have a way to process it. That's a really important piece.
So in addition to dealing with grief, though, yeah. I assume a lot of what you do in the coaching is on a more positive level. Ways that people can, because people, as we were talking about before, people just, you know, are spinning. They're so upset. They want to do stuff. They don't know what it is. So what are some suggestions for how to get involved and how to be effective?
Well, I would say one of the things that is important to do is a little audit of a few different factors. There's five different factors that I like to look at. And this is just really to be able to determine where you're going to be able to make the most impact and probably have the most longevity. So you want to look at your passion, okay? What parts of the movement, what parts of animal practices, what animals, whatever, what really like call to you, okay?
Yeah.
That's something to consider. You also need to consider your assets, okay? What can you bring to the table? Do you have accounting skills? Are you a good speaker? Are you really great with details? Do you like to be behind the scenes and organize? Are you really great with charming people? Like, do you have an education degree? All these things, figuring out. Yeah. And also, do you come from a place and experiences that are fairly unique to the movement that we need to hear more of? Making a little bit of an audit of everything that you can bring to the table is another thing for you to do. Another piece would be then to look at the ways that you like to work. Do you like to work in collaboration? Do you like to work on your own? Do you like to take directions? Do you like to start something? Anyway, there's a lot of different pieces. And I actually, if you go onto one of my Changemaker sessions recently, you can do a process that around that, a longer process. And what you do is you kind of whittle it down and you figure out, okay, this is my best use of my time. Is there a campaign that I can apply this to? Is there an idea that I can start? Is there anybody that I can collaborate with this? Is there an organization that I can go to and offer this very particular service to? If you want to work with an organization, I always recommend that you figure out what you can do for them. We don't have time to figure out how to use you, right? So I love it when people come to me and they say, hey, I'm so-and-so. I have this education. I've had this experience. I see this gap and I would love to do this for you. You know, that's something I'm going to have time to look at and maybe could happen, right? So that's what needs to happen if you want to work with an organization. But there are so many solo ways to work as well. It's just about having consistency. For example, if your thing is writing, write yourself a letter to the editor every week. If you get a letter published every month, that's huge. That reaches a huge amount of people. So that's sort of in tactical forms the way to do it. But in my line of work, also what I really try to put forward is you need to have practices in your life that allow you to process all of the shit that you have to go through in order to be able to have space to grow yourself into that bright light that is going to inspire other people to listen, to trust you, to follow, to be influenced by you. We need every activist to have the power to be able to influence, whether it's in a tiny one-on-one conversation or whether it's through your Instagram account. So in order to be able to be that light, you need to take care of yourself. You need to sort out your pain and your grief, and you need to build the pieces in your life that bring you safety and joy.
Yeah, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Too many people in this movement have forgotten about joy because it's kind of hard to find it, but you know, it's absolutely crucial. Well, all of these are unbelievably good pieces of advice. Mm. Before I let you go, I want to go back over the resources that are available because I want to make sure everybody understands there are all of the Animal Justice Academy resources are free.
Yes, they
then are. You yourself in your coaching business offer some resources for free and then other resources for which people can hire you. I just want you to sort that all out so that people who do want to pursue finding out more, doing more, will know where to go.
Okay, so if you're interested in being a part of Animal Justice Academy, you go to animaljusticeacademy.com and all you do is you sign up and we will give you instant access to the course. You'll get first notice of events. You'll get notice of the collective actions. Easy, easy, easy. If you want to be part of the Changemaker sessions, you can find that on my website. And I'm sure we can have a link, right?
Yes, of course. Marianne? We'll put a link in the show notes.
But everything can be found on my website, KimberlyCarroll.com. And that's completely free. And it's a really beautiful community that we're building. And I love having a community of mixed social justice people, especially us as animal advocates. I am involved in lots of social justice movements. Animal advocacy is the one that is dearest to my heart. But I think it's so important that we start building more bridges between social justice movements.
Yeah, that is a great way to reach people who are open to arguments about fairness and caring.
Who are already compassionate.
Yeah.
And then I also have a free course. It's a 5-part video course called Power Tools for Changemakers. And so a lot of the things we just started to touch on, like boundaries, like pain processing techniques, like having a daily habit to keep you resilient, productivity tips, that's all in that course. And again, that's on my website. It's totally free. And it'll just give you a good taste. I think it's a really nice little way to get that kicked off in your life.
So many resources. And it's not just for Canadians.
No, no. My Changemaker stuff, people from all over the world take part in that. There's nothing geographically specific about that. And Animal Justice Academy too. We, again, people from all over the world.
Yeah, there's some things that are Canadian specific, but plenty that aren't in the Animal Justice Academy as well.
That's right. And when it comes to my work with changemakers, with the Changemaker sessions, I'm all about sort of that deep inner work, but I'm also about how do we tangibly do things. Like, I'm all about tools and techniques, not just this sort of ambiguous, like, love yourself or make sure you're doing self-care. Like, I'm like, what does loving yourself mean? How do you do self-care? This is all about the journey I've been on, Marianne, myself, over the last like 25 years. And like things that I wish at the beginning of my activism journey, I had known and I was steeped
in.
And so I'm really just trying to bring it all out and do my part.
Well, that is great, Kimberly. You're doing amazing, amazing work. And thanks so much for sharing it with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Everybody that's here, thank you for the work that you do in this world. It's so important, and I so appreciate you.
Boy, ain't that the truth.
Social media is such an important part of the landscape today, even if you don't like it. But please do include our hen house in your digital horizons. You can like us and follow us on Instagram and TikTok and X and Facebook by searching for Our Hen House. Of course, you can always find us online at ourhenhouse.org, where you can check out past episodes or support our efforts. And you're always welcome to email us at info@ourhenhouse.org if you have any questions or if you want to share something you'd like us to discuss on the show. Thanks so much and see you online.
Anxieties are rising. Lab-grown meat. 2024's dark horse candidate. These are literally rising anxieties expressed on meetingplace.com by Jack Hubbard, who writes the Free Range Thoughts column. He is from Berman, the advocacy firm that, that loves to put us and many other things down. Lab-grown meat is here, he says. You can only find it at a handful of restaurants in the U.S. and Singapore. Will that change in 2024? Perhaps. So far, it's not really big information. Perhaps it will. Perhaps it won't. Ultimately, though, he says it's a matter of time. I hope he's right. I really do. The problem is, of course, as he points out, that it's not cost-effective yet. But he also points out that hundreds of top scientists around the world, backed by billions of dollars, are trying to solve the cost issue. Again, I really hope he's right. This sounds really, really promising. And he says that advocates, many of whom are animal rights activists, which I think is true. Not every animal rights activist is enthusiastic, but a lot are. Say lab-grown meat is a clean analog to natural meat, while supposedly having benefits for the environment or personal health. Well, yeah, I mean, like supposedly, if you don't believe any science, yeah, you could call it supposed, but it's actually just a fact. But there's downsides. And, you know, those animal rights advocates, apparently they don't mention these downsides. One is how lab-grown meat could displace family farmers. Oh my God. What a tragedy. Let's just keep having factory farms so that we can not displace family farmers, as I frequently say. Everybody's got a family of some sort or another. All right. Some families, though, he says, have been farming or ranching for generations, and they'll see their legacies end. And what I say is, who gives a fuck? Like, what? I mean, I just don't understand why. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe we're supposed to pretend like we feel sorry for these people. Like, things change, you know? Like, if you might have a legacy in your family of making widgets, and you had the big widget factory, and, you know, like, times pass. Processors, this is my favorite. Processors will also be affected by fewer livestock. Oh my God, the slaughterhouses are going to have to go out of business. This is just awful. All right, let's forget it. What? All right. He also is talking about feed. That's a real problem. We'll have to reduce the feed crops grown. Oh my God, we'll have to grow less food on agricultural land. So I guess we'll have more food for people to eat. Like, this is, how is that a problem? I just don't get it. This in turn could have a depressing effect on land values. Well, you know, if you own land that could be used for farming and you can no longer buy feed crops for largely for export, but for consumption by factory farms here, you could grow other things like vegetables, to say nothing of all the rural job loss linked to raising and processing livestock. Oh, yeah, all those great jobs in the slaughterhouses. God, those people are going to, like, what are they going to do? They're going to have to get jobs, like, doing something else. It's just unbelievable. Let's just keep it the way it is. Further centralization of the food supply. Does he exactly know how many people, how many companies own slaughterhouses in this country? I think it's four major companies produce, like, unbelievable amounts of our food. But so, you know, he's saying all these things just aren't going to stop it, even though they're, I guess he thinks they're really bad, but they're not going to stop it because there's a lot of money going into it. But he points out lab-grown meat companies may have forgotten one thing. The biggest factor in determining the ballgame is consumer sentiment. Will people eat lab-grown meat? Oh my God, we never thought of that. I'm sure none of the people putting money in this ever thought, oh, but maybe people don't want to eat it. Like, it never entered anybody's mind. So he started, I guess it's Berman, his agency, has started a conversation at labmeat.com. I'm sure you're going to want to check out that entertaining website. So, you know, basically it's going to be a PR site, I think, probably to criticize what he calls lab-grown meat. And one thing, you know, that we should be looking at is the use of immortalized cells. These are cells that have been modified so they replicate indefinitely, behaving like a tumor. Oh my God, they want us to eat tumors. I shouldn't laugh because, you know, they'll probably convince people that that's exactly what what cultivated meat is. Also, this is crazy. They've never been a food for humans, so there are no long-term health studies. Well, it is very common, actually, when something new comes is invented, that there are no long-term studies because it hasn't been around for a long time. There was one article where there was a higher level of lead in something. I don't know. That sounds like something that maybe could be fixed. Advocates are going to paper over inconvenient truths or inquiries. Unlike industry, they would never do such a thing. So it's up to other people, i.e. him, to start raising issues and having conversations. Yeah, like, because nobody else wants to talk about this. There are two ways to look at lab-grown meat's future. Either it flops or it doesn't. That is actually, I mean, even though, like, who cares the way he puts it, but it's much more likely that it will get partially accepted. Like, it's very unlikely it's either going to be one way or the other. Though if they get the cost down and the taste up, you know, it's over for animal killers. But he actually, you know, he's pretty sure this is going to happen. So he thinks that consumers need to learn about what's behind this new technology so they can make an informed decision for their future family dinner table. I think most consumers will probably wait until it's actually available. But, you know, if you want to talk about it, I'm glad to hear about it. All right. A field trip to the farm. Yay. This is on Hordes Dairy, man. And this is by Jenna Byrne, and she's talking about providing a hands-on learning experience at a real dairy farm for local fourth graders. It's an annual tradition our family enjoys. All right, so these people own a dairy farm in Wisconsin, Dairy State, They're worried because with more generations having been removed from the farm than ever before, now is the time to tell our story. It seems to me that like they never shut up telling their story, but you know, whatever. So for the past 15 years, their farm has had the opportunity to tell their dairy farming story by hosting an annual field trip for our local fourth grade students. 15 years they've been feeding kids this nonsense. Yeah, and they say that animal rights activists are the ones who have the lead in telling the story. All right, hosting 60 rambunctious fourth graders is no easy task. You know, teachers kind of do it every day. All right, so in the week leading up to the field trip, they get lessons, and each day the children are given a presentation on a certain facet of Wisconsin agriculture. Cranberries, oh, that's nice. I didn't know they raised cranberries in Wisconsin. Honey, maple syrup, that's great. Beef, dairy, and potatoes. So then they go to a dairy farm. Why don't they go to a potato farm? I don't know. God, you can go to a potato farm and they can give you French fries. That I would go on that trip. So these kids arrive and they have different stations where they learn about feeding, machinery, the milking process, calf care, and milk's journey from bulk tank to the store. But the most popular site is the milk the cow by hand stop. Okay, hold the phone here. Like, I thought we were telling them about how dairy farms actually work. Nobody is milking the cows by hand anymore. That's not what's happening. Oh, but you know, we wouldn't want to tell them like that. That would be depressing. So instead they have this poor cow, poor little angel who, you know, had her baby taken away from her. She gets the dad to guide all of these 60 children who are screaming and shrieking with nervousness and excitement. And for many, this is the first time they have gotten to experience such a feat. Yeah, it's the last time too, because even if they go work on a dairy farm, this isn't what anybody does. This is not what a dairy farm is like. They're feeding these children like insane myths about what life is really like on these places. It's all a lie. After a long day of learning about what life on a real dairy farm may look like, no, that's not what they're doing. And then they compete in relay races, which have nothing to do with dairy farming other than, you know, like they're carrying hay. And then they get to enjoy ice cream, milk, and cheese. Oy vey. That's all I have to say. All right. No, this is worse. Well, there's always a lot of competition amongst my articles. Chicken donuts spur concession sales at Rodeo Houston. This is from Watt Agnet, which is, of course, a poultry site, so they're all excited about this. When people think of rodeo and meat, they usually think of beef because, you know, they're watching the cows, so they think like, oh, let's eat them. I guess that's how people think at the rodeo. I don't know. Like, he's running around. All right, let's kill him and eat him. All right, that isn't necessarily the case in Houston. This is by Roy Graber. He likes the rodeo, and he's kind of excited that there's now at the Rodeo Houston, which apparently is a very big one, this donut chicken sandwich for sale. And according to an Axios article, it sells for $16 at multiple concession stands. I guess that isn't that expensive. like, what am I talking about? $16 isn't that much money anymore. I'm living in the past. All right. The Axios reporter said, from my first bite, I was hooked. The donuts were perfectly glazed. All right. These donuts are made out of the dead bodies of chickens. Just remember that. The donuts were perfectly glazed, still warm from being made, but cool enough to handle with my bare hands. Oh, well, it was warm, but cool. The chicken grounded the whole thing, and I appreciated the gentle kick from the seasonings. Make me vomit. They talked about how much glaze was on the donut. You know, if there's one way to make something taste good, it's like putting a lot of sugar on it. And the gooiness of the entree, was the chicken actually gooey? Because it's been a while since I've eaten a chicken. But my recollection is that gooiness was not what you were going for. But, you know, they all loved it. He gave all these persons were talking about how it was terrific. There was one critic who said it tastes like diabetes. Yeah, it tastes like death and despair, I think. But, that's what people like to eat. They like to eat death and despair. And apparently in Houston at the rodeo, they like to eat bird-related death and despair. And that's it for this week's Rising Anxieties.
That's it for this week's show. As always, if you enjoy the podcast and you're able, we would be honored if you would join our Flock Friends community starting at $10 a month or $100 a year. Visit ourhenhouse.org/support to check out our tiered membership levels with really great names, by the way. You can become part of our Chick Click, our Squawk Squad, our Henhouse Heroes, or our Barnyard Benefactors. Some of the perks include being part of a community with great alliteration. I'm kidding, but I'm also not kidding. But some of the real perks include weekly bonus content and, get this, monthly invitations to join Marianne and me for a live recording of an Our Hen House podcast episode, followed by an opportunity to meet with the guest. And since Our Hen House is a 501c3 nonprofit, your donation is fully tax deductible to the full extent of the law. Another great way to support us is to give us 5 stars on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts, or leave us a friendly review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. Also, like us on Facebook, where you can also leave us a review, or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Our Hen House. And of course, tell your friends about us. If you're one of our listeners who already supports us, thank you so much. And thank you to my co-host, Marianne Sullivan, to Vicki Beechler for her work in producing this podcast, and to composer Michael Herron for the music. Thanks to Eric Montgomery of the podcast Haven for his work editing this podcast, and to Veronica Kalinska, who designed our amazing logos and other graphics. And special thanks to Jen Riley. We will be back next week with a brand new show, so don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher. Thank you so much for your support, compassion, and for your dedication to animals. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye.